Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and welcome to our panel section. We are doing things a little bit differently this week in the sense that we're going to start off trying to raise some money for the lockbox, which Ray and I just completed. But that doesn't mean just because we're not actively fundraising doesn't mean that you have to stop giving, and whatever you can do helps that lockbox. We are at $226,000, and anything you can do to help would be greatly, greatly appreciated. So, for everyone who gave this morning, thank you so much to our panelists who were waiting patiently in the green room. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to have you here now to talk about the stories of the day. Let me introduce them and we'll get started. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Mike Spain is here, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius Kelly. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, everyone.
And public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here. And Joe, I just want to say, I know all the listeners know it, we all know it, but you are a treasure. And reminded again about that on Sunday when I had the good fortune to be at the event with Doris Kearns Goodwin, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, who Joe interviewed. And it was an extraordinary conversation, and thanks to you, just an amazing job, Joe. Incredible moment. I talked to a number of people around me in the audience, and ended up meeting several people who are WAMC listeners. So shout out to all of them. But kudos to you, Joe. What an incredible interview. I mean, it really felt like I was at a moment in history there.
Well,
and
thanks
to your good guidance.
It was a very special day. She's an incredible woman and a special woman, and we had a very meaningful conversation. We're going to be airing that at some point when we end the fund drive. I don't even know when.
That's the incentive at the
end,
right?
So yet another thing that we're going to hold hostage till the that we have to hold hostage until we make the money. Yeah. But very, very special, and kudos to all the folks at UPH and to the North Shore Bookstore for putting that event together, and we really look forward to it. But no, she is a force to be reckoned with, and I just had a delightful.
But you guided
time.
Her through, an amazing conversation. Clearly, yeah. She was comfortable with you. I guess you'd interviewed her 4 or 5 times before.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, this shows what the power of this station and your hosting ability. So thanks for that.
You're very sweet. Thank you very much. Let's go to what we have to talk about today, and that is quite a lot, actually. And don't you worry. We're going to get everything in. I promise you. And we begin with the Fauci hearings yesterday. I thought that this is a story that made a little news and maybe not quite as much as I would have expected it to. And what I mean by that is that I quite frankly, and maybe this is a blank spot in my knowledge, but I didn't know it was coming up until it was here, that it was something I didn't know it was paramount on the schedule. But it was. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the former government scientist, both celebrated and despised for his work on COVID on Monday, forcefully denied Republican allegations that he had helped fund research that sparked the pandemic or had covered up the possibility it originated in a laboratory, calling the accusations absolutely false and simply preposterous. In an occasionally testy appearance before the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic, Dr. Fauci read aloud an email from February 2020 in which he urged a prominent scientist who was then suspicious about a lab leak to, quote, determine if his concerns are validated, and if so, very quickly report them to the FBI. It is inconceivable that anyone who reads this email could conclude that I was trying to cover up the possibility of a laboratory leak, Dr. Fauci testified. I have to say, as I was seeing portions of the hearing on television and was watching this, I thought to myself, and maybe I'm alone on this, but I thought to myself, first of all, the guy is in his 80s. He's retired. Why don't they just leave him alone? I guess you don't get that kind of. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that they're not leaving him alone because they are trying to they raise money off this, and I also think that they're trying to create a buffer for Trump because he was responsible, you know, because of the way he mishandled the COVID response. Trump and his team, including Dr. Ronny Jackson, who was in the White House at the time and who's now a congressman and should have been ashamed of himself for the things he said at that hearing yesterday. But Trump and his team mishandled the response to COVID, sending out very confusing messages. They did get the vaccine, but they didn't have a plan to get it out and into arms. The Biden administration, when they took over, they did that beautifully, very successfully. But I think that part of this was to try to begin to buffer some of the criticism that I think will come in the next couple of months as people are reminded about what really did happen in the Trump administration. And it was blame shifting. And you could tell a number of the congressmen, the way they were asking the questions, it appeared to be specifically for the purpose of creating sound bites, political sound bites, and not just one or two of them, several of them, and just retelling these conspiracy lies.
Mm-hmm. And clearly it wasn't about scientific research or evidence, because several of the Congress members identified themselves as being anti-science or not understanding how data is collected and has to be, you have to respond when you have a pandemic based on the data you have available at that time. And then with more data coming in, you adjust accordingly. And that happens worldwide. And it happened with this pandemic as well. So the entire sort of setup, as you said, Teresa, was all about sound bites, was all about sort of, you know, having us forget that it was Trump who said to inject bleach in our system or to clean out the virus or whatever crazy anti-science ideas he had in his head.
Or suggest medicines that were not appropriate for the
Vermectin, the horse medicine, and all these crazy ideas.
Dissuade people from wearing masks.
Yes.
Dissuade people from six. Sort of if the viewers, if the listeners don't know or haven't seen this, I mean, the key thing that the conspiracy folks, the Trump and his conspiracy folks are saying is that Fauci's responsible for the 6 feet distance, saying 6 feet distance and there's no scientific basis for that is their claim. They're saying that, you know, mask didn't work and he knew that and they were masking children and elders, that he was responsible for shutting down the schools and shutting down businesses and such, and that there was no science behind that. What they're forgetting is that 5,000 or more people were dying every single day. You know, that's 9/11 plus 2,000 people every single day were dying, day after day after day. And that
You needed to take emergency measures. Yeah, I mean, that's completely appropriate. And adding to what both of you are saying, and I think you've summed it up really well, is that, it was an extraordinarily stressful, unpleasant, terrible experience for our nation collectively, the world collectively. So now they want to blame somebody. And blame shifting, as you said, Teresa, is exactly what's going on here. Let's blame Fauci. And he already, because of, other politicians having done this, he's been demonized. He's become a symbol of everything we don't like about the pandemic, except he gets no credit from these people for the extraordinary success in coming out of that and coming up with ways to combat that and minimize the damage. And it took a while. But the fact is that they having seen some of the clips from last night and read the transcripts in the news reports today, I am very, very gratified that he came prepared. I think his answers were sharp. I think he took them on and made them look foolish. Of course, mm-hmm. they won't include his responses in their sound bites that they use to raise their funds with, as you point out, Teresa. But that's but well, he was sharp.
But how many times prior to that had they brought him up to talk to
Congress?
It
was pretty common.
Yeah, I mean, it was common. I mean, and so it just seemed like a retread of that.
Oh, yeah.
And what – so – I am unaware of this, so please fill in this gap in my knowledge. What are they trying to accomplish in the sense of what how do they quote unquote get him?
So the ostensibly this hearing was about something that's very important.
Yes.
Ostensibly this hearing was to look back and see what the lessons learned were and what changes that we need to make to try to improve the next time.
And prepare for
and
the
prepare.
Next time.
So very, very legitimate. And he came in voluntarily a couple months ago. I don't remember how long.
January,
Thank you.
Closed
for
door.
For a closed door 14-hour interview with staff and others. And because, you know, he agrees you need to look back and see what you learned, what you didn't learn. But in the background, there are all these conspiracy theories. The key one is that he is making money from patents, and he had a grant, or somebody had through his agency had a grant with the Wuhan lab, and that this virus actually came out of the Wuhan lab, and that he tried to cover that up because they had the grant, and he totally discredited that. He has he did it. He totally discredited that with the receipts, with facts a couple years ago and last year and again yesterday. And this morning I'm writing in, and sorry, Joe, I was listening to you a little bit, but I also was listening to conservative radio. What were they doing? Now, I just wanted to hear, separately, I was going back and forth.
No, I understand,
But so what they're doing today is still saying these conspiracy theories and just saying he's lying, Yeah. He came to Congress and he's lying. I mean,
with no basis of facts.
He had the emails. I mean,
did they ever need any facts, to be honest, for these panels?
No, I mean, that's
panels?
The trouble. It's just being able to say the rhetorical offensive statement and not having to account for it.
And anybody who pays attention clearly has a different position. And, you know, I think we had this conversation earlier. My husband Bill and I had dinner with Fauci along with other colleagues about 10 years ago at Siena when he was a speaker at our graduation. And I must say, as you said, he's very sharp. He's very interested in having scientific conversations. And he's a great public servant because he came on a weekend and we asked him, so why were you doing that? You're so busy anyways. And he said, you know, he loves to get out of D.C., out of big cities, to talk to regular folks about what's going on with, you know, medicine, science, and research. And we had a lovely dinner conversation, and he was a very interesting person to learn from. So
he's brilliant.
He's brilliant. We have great respect for him. And personally, I can say he's a very good human being.
Yeah. I mean, he's a great American hero.
I stand by that.
I mean, beginning with AIDS and then with Ebola, the way the U.S. handled that, and then thankfully, he was there during the pandemic and was able to guide us through that and saved, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of lives.
And he was the lead researcher in HIV, and he collaborated with the George George Bush president on the HIV campaigns in this country, and he worked on revising and using evidence to adjust our policies, which were eventually
updated to better respond
and saved lots of people.
One of the things they talked about in the hearing that I found so sad, but you know it's happening.
1 minute, but go ahead.
They asked him about the death threats. And he was saying that there's when you have an avalanche of accusations, these false claims like this, the death threats increase tremendously. And he said, well, it's difficult for him. What is most troublesome, and he really choked up about this, is the threats to his wife, the death threats to his wife and his children.
Yep.
And that he now has to have security all the time. And you see this, the judges, you see this in the scientists,
FBI agents
across the board. If you do anything against the Trump, then you get these death threats. And that is just a sad situation in our country that, It just is abhorrent.
We'll pause there to take a break, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have letters already. We'll get to those and continue our conversation with our great panelists in just a moment. First, we have this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel segment this morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Mike Spain joining us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have letters. We were talking about Dr. Fauci and his testimony yesterday. Letters like this from John, Hunter Biden, Dr. Fauci, et cetera, are just another attempt by the MAGA crowd to divert the attention away from Trump. Some may think Trump is a crook, but so are all these other people. So all of that doesn't make Trump look any worse than all the others.
Interesting strategy, but that, yeah, possibly.
That from John. Charles says from the New York Times yesterday, whether the pandemic started on a lab bench or in a market stall, it is undeniable that the U.S. federal funding helped to build an unprecedented coalition of SARS-like viruses at the Wuhan Institute, as well as contributing to research that enhanced them. Advocates and funders of the Institute's research, including Dr. Fauci, should cooperate with the investigation to help identify and close the loopholes that allowed such dangerous work to occur.
I recommend that you listen to the hearing. Dr. Fauci addressed that repeatedly, talking about the details of the science and what the U.S. did fund and what they didn't fund. $125,000 grant, as I recall. And he explained repeatedly how those grant funds could not have possibly been used to create this virus in the lab. And he also says he remains open-minded about what the source of the virus is, that they think they know what it is, but they're not certain yet, and he's always open to new information. But listen to the hearing, listen to the facts.
We got this from Zach, who said, Dr. Fauci should have been more combative. He's got nothing to lose. He should have cut Marjorie Taylor Greene off and said, okay, then arrest me. Go ahead, I dare you. And when she calls him a liar, say, yeah, you already said that. This is old news. Go fix the problems in your own district. This is from Zach, am kind of sick of all of us letting these nut jobs dominate everything. Let's start calling them out on their malarkey.
The problem with that is that would just denigrate. You know, he would be stepping down to do that. I think he looked much more classy, just accepting it and responding with facts and being firm. You know, but you do want to go after her for her absurdities. But it's almost worthless. You just give more ammunition and egg her on more when you do that kind of thing.
All right. Next topic that to discuss on this somewhat abbreviated version of our roundtable panel. We hate go until 11 o'clock this morning. The RNC co-chair, Laura Trump, yes, she is related, attacks former Governor Larry Hogan for calling for respect for the legal process. So the co-chair of the Republican National Committee and daughter-in-law of Donald Trump slammed the former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. Why, you ask? Well, because he urged Americans to respect the verdict in the former president's hush money trial. Hogan is running for Senate in Maryland. He represents one of the GOP's best chances at taking back control of the chamber. Still, Laura Trump, who was recently named co-chair of the party alongside Michael Wadley, said on CNN's State of the Union that Hogan doesn't deserve the respect of any Republican for his comments. On Thursday, before the jury verdict was delivered, Hogan posted on X that Americans should respect the verdict and the legal process. We must reaffirm what has made this nation great, the rule of law. Hogan said, urging the public not to pour fuel on the fire with more toxic partisanship. I would just add before we talk about this fully that Larry Hogan has been known to be a straight shooter, someone who is, I would call him a calm in many storms, and has been, was that way throughout the Trump administration, and continues that way as he looks to run for Senate in the state of Maryland. Teresa.
Well, I found this to be fascinating in that that they would go after what is probably their strongest, one of their strongest candidates around the country, and someone who Senator McConnell, Mitch McConnell, worked very hard to get to run. It was quite a surprise that he agreed to run, but I think Senator McConnell thinks his best, Larry Hogan's his best chance of the Republicans taking back control of the Senate. And if you step back for a minute and think about it, what the MAGA crowd is saying is what Trump has been saying, is that if you respect the basic functions of our democracy, which is our judicial, one of the basic functions of our democracy, which is a judicial system, we don't think you're a good candidate. We don't think you should get funding. That is an astounding message. Now, I know that's what they've been saying, but this attack on our judicial system is abhorrent, and the fact that they would attack their own candidate and now say that they're going to withhold money from him, while that might be, in a sense, good for Democrats, because it would be helpful if the Democrats could win the seat, and if they weaken their candidate, that improves our chances, but it's bad for democracy.
Larry Hogan has been a really interesting governor,
yes.
I think. And
beloved.
Beloved. Very well respected, and so is his wife Yumi Hogan, who is Korean born. And you remember when Larry Hogan and his wife Yumi got themselves in trouble with the Trump administration because Larry Hogan relied on his wife to get hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of masks into the United States to save lives, right? So he's deeply respected by people who revere a functioning democratic system that aids all people. He's a great public servant. And to sort of see how appalling Laura Trump's attack on him is, really, to sort of suggest that anybody who says anything critical about Trump should not be elected. I mean, to me, this is so low. It is so appalling, and it shows how profoundly divided this country is in terms of being anti-science, anti-reason, anti-democratic structure. It is quite shocking to me over and over again. I agree with you, Teresa.
To me, the day of the conviction, yeah. It was one of the most shocking things for me on the day of the conviction when I read that.
Yeah,
I think that really right now you have to look at this conviction and the rhetoric by the MAGA group about it, you know, being a travesty of justice and et cetera, as big lie part two. Mm. I mean, you really right now what's going on with Larry Hogan is a warning to all Republican politicians. Yep. Either you come out and criticize it and say it was a travesty of justice, or shut your mouth. Don't come out and say a jury of his peers, as much as you can say their peers, but of citizens who gave up and didn't ask for, but were brought in and sat for 7 weeks, listened to the facts, and worked out a unanimous verdict, which is extraordinary, and found for the first time Donald Trump guilty of a criminal offense. And, you know, that's something the Senate had a chance to do twice. And they just acted political and they didn't do it. And now citizens did the right thing. And it's just a big lie, too. That's the way it sounds to me.
It should be. You're right. It's a warning. It's a warning shot to all other Republicans that you have to be fully in on Trump, or else you're not.
Or shut up.
Shut up, or
fully be a coward and just shut up. Yeah.
But it should be a warning to Republicans who care about democracy that if you need to speak up now, you need to speak up in defense of Larry Hogan. If you really believe in the American system of government, if you really believe in the three tenets of, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial system, if you really believe that the judicial system is fundamental to our democracy, you need to stand up for Larry Hogan. And there has been deafening silence. Deafening silence. Yeah. And I think this is a very scary signal, and the voters should pay close attention to this. I know it's a thing at the margin.
But they should ask. They should ask every politician running for re-election, every Congress member and every Senate candidate that's up, what is your opinion of this verdict in New York City? And they should be forced to be accountable about it. And that should tell us volumes.
Right.
I mean, and we're seeing this become such an issue in close Senate races, and even races that aren't as close, that, and congressional races that are becoming even closer. The other thing that I find interesting about this is we have James Comey on later on, and I taped that interview yesterday, late yesterday afternoon, and we talk about this very subject of what the Republicans are doing, of not only going after, of course, President Biden, but going after our judicial system, going the heart of our judicial system, and making it a mockery, and at the highest levels, which obviously the former head of the FBI finds deeply concerning.
And they're going after the system rhetorically, right? They're and so that makes people less confident in the system. But they are also going after the judicial system in their budget cuts. If you look at the budgets that they're moving through, they're proposing deep, deep cuts in the number of prosecutors and others because they're going to get the deep state. Are you serious? I mean, and they say that they're the law and order folks.
Yeah.
You can't say you're law and order if you're going after judges and the judicial system in the way they are. And the third thing, and we'll go back to the situation with Fauci, is I was listening and reading some reports about the incredible uptick in the threats against Judge Marchant and Bragg and others, but all across the board, these death threats in these swatting so on and so forth.
And general intimidation strategy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to get people to not believe in your judicial system. You're scaring people away from participating in it for fear of their own lives and their families' lives. Mm-hmm. And you're cutting their budgets. And you say you're law and order?
Mm. Well, it's Hitleresque, because that's what the Nazi Party did in the 20s. You know, they called for law and order, and they, you know, swapped the existing law and order for their law and order.
And the antidote to this is voting. I mean, really, in the end, it's just like the jury, citizens decided. This is going to be decided by voters who are going to say, we do or do not believe in our system of democracy.
Yep. Let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll hit another subject before we end our panel discussion this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Teresa Bourgeois, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Mike Spain joining us, and we're very excited to have all of them here this morning, and we'll be here until 11 o'clock, so we have a few moments to discuss a few more items. The other story I would like to get to is the election in Mexico. Voters in Mexico cement the governing party's dominance. Expectations were high for the leftist Morena party, and it exceeded them, potentially giving President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum and her allies the power to enact systemic change. This was really two women running, and it was Claudia Sheinbaum who won, elected. It was a margin, the biggest in decades, and even as the votes were still being counted on Monday, it became clear that Mexico's leftist governing party and its allies could be in a position to reshape the country's political landscape. Vera.
So this is a really interesting development. Not so much because she's the first woman president or she's the first Jewish woman president of Mexico. Of course, it's interesting to us. But what Morena, stands for is a fundamental change away from the globalization economic policies and reinvesting in Mexico itself. And we have seen that a lot of Mexicans have, you know, their income has risen, especially lower classes and lower middle classes. For the first time, Morena introduced a pension system which has changed people's lives. They're now able to retire without worry. A lot, you know, in comparison to the past, you know, they have
less worry.
Significantly less worry. We're all worried about those things, but less worry. They have at least a pension system. The income has grown significantly for the average and, you know, Mexican worker. So this party has stood against globalization policies and wants to reinstitute more governmental supervision of the economy. They're stopping the privatization of Pemex, which is the Mexican oil company. They're beginning to sort of pull back and go into a sort of a more statist economic model. And that, of course, helps in particular the lower classes. Now, you might have noticed after this election, the peso for the first time went down in value. That's because the elite economic class is not so happy about this overwhelming win of Morena. But most people in Mexico are clearly delighted with this. The reason we see a woman lead is because in Mexico they've instituted within the party system a quota structure. So it encourages and brings up women. And I want to do a quick comparison. The reason Angela Merkel was elected again and again in Germany as the chancellor is because the prior chancellor, Kohl, it elevated her to a position of power and, you know,
visibility.
Gave her the chance to rise, right? Sheinbaum has experienced the same thing. She has been elevated and she's been given an opportunity to speak and be elected in one of the most influential areas by the prior president. So this is a structural system that elevates women to the top. Now, of course, you know, for us, we might say how embarrassing Mexico. I mean, how good for Mexico that they have a female president before us, but
yet
embarrassing
another country
for us,
has it, yeah.
You know, embarrassing for us, perhaps. But we don't have the same structure where we elevate women to leadership. We have a lot of women leaders as governors in Mexico, as mayors in Mexico. This is not unusual in Mexico, even though we know we're familiar with, you know, female genocide, you know, the targeting of women on, you know, violence and sexualized violence against women and domestic abuse. Those are really serious issues that hopefully will also be addressed by this government.
Yeah. Is this government, you know, I mean, are they kind of clamping down law and order? That's happening throughout Central America where they're denying people civil liberties in order to fight crime. Is that an issue in Mexico so much?
So, I mean, they clearly have horrendous problems with, you know, violence, particularly related to the drug cartels. Mm-hmm. But Morena is opposed to prior government's use of the military against cartels. What they want to do is legalize marijuana and sort of try alternative social measures in addition to you know, police work.
So, question. She comes to this, as I understand it, with a pretty broad background on climate change, played on the world stage and the climate issues and so what does that say? How does that bode for what she might do in Mexico?
So she's not been, even though the party in general embraces, you know, more diversity, LGBTQ rights, women's rights, she herself has not been outspoken on either environmental protections or on women's rights or in LGBTQ rights. What she has emphasized is economic opportunity. And so I wouldn't expect them to lead on that. Because they're dealing with too much poverty that they have to overcome before they can be more environmentally concerned.
Yeah. This,
well,
I
unless
mean,
you take, sorry,
Yeah, mm-hmm. no, it kind of gives you the sense that Mexico, I mean, it's extraordinarily large population, diverse population, yep. culturally, several different, segments of it, and it's kind of on the rise. I mean, it is
on the rise. Yeah, yeah. I think
and that's going to be different than it has been for the United States as a partner.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think Mexico. Well, under the prior president, Mexico already wasn't intimidated by border-related issues and threats, and I don't think this will go any better for the current or next administration.
5 minutes. We have time for one more topic. We will have then gotten to all of our topics. Why? Because we care about you, the home listener. This is the story on President Biden expected to announce new asylum restrictions at the border. President Biden is expected to announce a plan Tuesday to temporarily shut off access to the U.S.-Mexico border and restrict asylum for immigrants. Mike Spain.
Yeah, I understand what the narrative is here, is that because Congress would not approve additional funding needed to process the thousands of immigrants that are coming over the border in Mexico, from Mexico, because of that, they need to take executive action. But it is very similar to the action that the Trump administration tried, and it did not succeed. It was blocked by the courts. And it is getting already labeled as being too little too late. It's just a response because he's worried about the poll. Biden is worried about the polls that show Trump more favorable in his handling of the border issues than Biden is currently trending on the polls. So it seems opportunistic, and I don't know that it's going to do a whole lot for him politically.
I mean, it's the same idea again for Biden to go after the centrist voter, and he's offending the left wing once again because he's denying the right to asylum for people to apply for
the internationally guaranteed right
of asylum. He's denying that, so it'll go to the courts. It'll be stayed immediately as soon as it's the executive action is implemented.
I think they expect that.
It's just
optics,
right? It's optics. It's not going to make a difference along the border. It might. It's the same kind of approach he uses in some ways. I mean, who knows if it's getting any better? We'll see in the next few days with Israel and Palestine. It's sort of like appealing to centrists and letting the left wing go,
And waiting perhaps too long to take a position like this. Yeah,
but I would say that it has a different forcing function, that it highlights the point that you need Congress to get into the legislative game. They're in the rhetoric game, but they're not in the legislative game. Yeah. And this is a forcing function that it's an important thing to say that we have to control, we can only process a certain number of people coming across the border. But the part that he doesn't have the power of is the power of the purse. Congress has to do that. And so this will not work unless Congress takes action and provides the resources necessary. And this is why the Border Patrol, who's typically for Trump and against him, we're for him on the compromise bill, right? Because it provided the resources to process people at the border. And I think this highlights the fact that that's needed, and that all these Republicans, and it's Trump who stopped that bipartisan compromise to address the border issue. It wasn't an immigration bill, but it was a border bill.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's a lot of
20 seconds.
Decent rationale for that, but I don't think that it's going to be seen that way. I think it's going to be seen as too little, too late, and they're going to use that. Yes,
but that's not the truth.
Mike, Vera, Teresa, you're all wonderful. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being so insightful and thoughtful today. We'll be back right after this.